Welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
And I'm an albatross.
Oh, well, don't try to fly away. You might hurt yourself. And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops-Tay-Sequim territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequim Ulu. And today's text, Flight of the Albatross by Deborah Savage, takes place in a lightly fictionalized version of Great Barrier Island, New Zealand, or Aotearoa, which, Joe, I 100% pronounced wrong in our Whale Rider episode. So this is my correction. It's okay. Aotearoa. This land is the traditional meeting grounds or marae of the Ngātiwai. In acknowledging this territory, we acknowledge Tangata, Wanu, and the importance of the Treaty of Waitangi. And Joe, I think this text is interesting because Maori culture plays a huge role in the narrative.
Yes.
But the book is written by a white woman from the U.S., and I think that we have maybe accidentally stumbled upon a somewhat problematic text that doesn't have a lot of stuff written about it. So, like, unpacking it, I think, is going to be kind of complicated today.
Yeah. So, folks, this was one of the titles that came up on the list of, you know, common titles about New Zealand. And when I selected it, I didn't realize that Deborah Savage was not a New Zealand native. You know, she lived there for a number of years when she was in, I think, her late teens and early 20s. And she's written at least four different books that involve white people interacting with, learning from, maybe gently appropriating the culture of Maori people. So I think it's an interesting phenomenon because, of course, we started to have the conversation last week with Whale Rider, where we were talking about the white filmmaker who was adapting the Maori text. And then this week, it's like, this book is so Maori-centric, but how is it using the culture? And I think, yeah, the fact that we're telling a story about a white girl and a Maori boy complicates things.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we'll get into the plot summary and everything in a second, but I think it is important to acknowledge that, like, my understanding is that Deborah Savage married into a white New Zealand family and then later divorced from it. And so a lot of her early experiences, particularly when she did live on Great Barrier Island for 2 years, were in the context of her husband's family.
Okay.
And I think that the book does show a really good awareness of the kinds of racism that Maori people experience or certainly experienced in the 80s when the book is set. I think there's a really strong awareness of, it's not framed as white privilege, but that idea of, like, white people being in a position of power over Maori within the community and, like, the kinds of situations that a character like Makau, like, run into because of that. And at the same time, like, pretty much all the Maori characters just exist so that Sarah can, like, learn about herself.
Yeah.
And she really is a bit of a savior figure in a lot of ways. Like, it's only through the magic that is Sarah that, like, this albatross is healed and lives again. And this Maori boy finds his way to a new future and becomes a poet. And, like, some of it is pretty cringe and some of it is pretty respectful. And I think that's a tension that we just have to, like, accept in the book.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so Brenna, you're starting to go into some of the plot points, but what is Flight of the Albatross about?
All right, I'm going to try to do this without, like, usually, you know, I've drawn on a whole bunch of notes and things, and there's, like, really nothing out there, so you'll have to correct me if I miss anything, Joe, but
okay.
We have a protagonist, her name is Sarah, and she's gone to spend the summer with her mother. Her mother is an extremely successful scientist and a pretty crappy mom.
Boy, she is a workaholic who, I mean, I appreciate the fact that we do get this reveal near the end of the book that definitely confirms that Pauline realizes she wished she had done things different and she doesn't want Sarah to just idolize her and follow in her steps in terms of becoming the best she can possibly be. But yeah, this mom kind of sucks.
This mom kind of sucks. And also, like, every other character in the book is judging her so hard.
Truly, yes.
Because Sarah does idolize her mother as this high-flying, successful scientist, but the rest of the town is like, that lady is weird. So Sarah has come to New Zealand to spend the summer with her mother and try to connect with her. Her mom abandoned the family effectively when she was six and has had very limited contact. A couple of visits, a couple of like really fancy spectacular trips like to Disney World, and some letters. But really, her dad has been the person raising her day to day. And we don't know a lot about Sarah, really. Like, she's a really good student. She's an obsessive flute player, wants to be the greatest flute player in the world. But in other ways, she's kind of, I don't know, like, empty is a strong word, Joe, but there's not a lot to this character, except that she's, like, wildly judgmental. I texted you and I was like, okay, she's a bit of a pill. Like, she's constantly obsessed with everybody's weight, including her own. She worries that she's fat, that she's ugly. She worries that about other people around her. And she's sort of fascinated by people who can just be in the world. And it's actually a little bit of a resentment that she feels to her mom, because her mom is actually very comfortable, like, in her body and in the world, even though she obviously has this one big regret that, anyway. So turns out the weather sucks in New Zealand during North American summer break,
right? Oh, yeah, because it's the winter.
Yeah, and she's like, oh my God, I came here and it's cold and it's raining all the time and it's horrible. And she's kind of by herself because her mom doesn't really, like, change her plans or her schedule at all to accommodate her long-lost daughter being in town. So left to her own devices, she becomes friends with the neighbors and the neighbor boy, Mako, who is this sort of troubled kid. He has left school, and everybody's kind of concerned by him being politicized by his father. And Joe, I'm really interested to hear about what you think about the politics of the book, because in many ways, the book is interested in Maori culture, but very suspicious of any sort of movement towards Maori liberation. And in fact, a big set piece in the book is like Mako finding out from an elder in the community that his father's sense of like where they've come from is actually like all a lie. And I was kind of, I know we'll get into it later, but I was kind of fascinated by that because, I don't know, it really kind of undercuts the idea. It's like, you should be proud of being Maori, but not like that.
Well, it feels like the white person's version of like identity politics or pride, right? You know, Mako should want to do something with his life that isn't gangland violence or petty theft or even fishing. But at the same time, he shouldn't be a revolutionary like his father, because that could be dangerous. And mostly by that, we mean dangerous to white people.
Well, and there's something very interesting about, you know, one of the things that Sarah does to show that she wants to connect with him is she buys him a biography of Martin Luther King Jr. And I'm kind of fascinated by that move rhetorically, because like the ways in which the American political establishment had already by this point, so the book comes out in 1989, like had already really been working hard to whitewash Martin Luther King as a figure and like sand the edges off his revolutionary nature. And so the fact that like she doesn't buy him a book about Malcolm X, right? She buys him a book about Martin Luther King Jr. And it's like, this is so interesting from the perspective of quelling the drive to rebellion that is really like motivating Mako. But I mean, everybody just sees it as anger, right? So it is interesting to me. This is very much where the book starts to become like a white person's view of the struggle of the Maori, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It absolutely is that. But I don't want to suggest that it's ill intention. Like, I don't think it's setting out to do this deliberately. I think Savage looks at this as, and even some of the early reviews when the book originally came out suggest that this is a kind of like cross-cultural love affair where they both learn more about themselves through the process of helping this injured bird. And when you look at it through that lens, it's beautiful and nice and open. But yeah, you know, when we look at it now, there's definitely a bunch of problematic things about it.
Yeah, it's just that sort of that it is a small L liberal view of like identity politics and minority rights, right? And then like a real resistance to recognizing the value of revolutionary struggle, like for example. Anyway, all this to say, we've alluded to this bird. Sarah finds an albatross who's been wounded, a walking albatross specifically. And she takes it to Aunt Hattie, who's this elder, not really in the community. She's actually sort of secluded away from the community. And one of the reasons...
come on, Bretta. She's basically a witch.
Sarah definitely thinks she's a scary witch, for sure. I think she just might be an old lady. But anyway, all this to say, Sarah goes to her with the bird, even though, you know, her mother is this globally renowned expert on shore birds. Just interesting choice. And it really is sort of this thing that she wants to do and have for herself that is separate from her experience of being with her mother. But through Aunt Hattie, she also comes to understand that Mako is important, sacred, spiritual, and she has to let him touch her in order to grow as a human. It's very interesting. I mean, that's literally the language that they use.
It's true.
The important thing I think about the albatross with Religio is that it becomes something outside of Sarah's own self to focus on. Like, Sarah's a bit of a ruminator and a bit, like, self-involved and judgy about people, whereas committing to care for this albatross means visiting it every day, except for the days that she forgets, and also bringing it fish every day, which means that Mako has to go fishing for her every day to bring fish for the albatross. And so obviously this brings them together, their relationship grows, and they fall in love, and it all becomes upended in this big climactic scene when Sarah is told she's going to have to leave early because her mom has a new contract, ironically enough, working with albatrosses, and so she's going to have to leave early, so she freaks out on her mom and runs away to Aunt Hattie's, where the albatross is maybe ready to fly, and they end up taking it out on a boat, and the albatross goes off, and I'm pretty sure Aunt Hattie dies, and they fall in love, and the end.
Well, and that's kind of why I said, oh, she's a bit of a witch, because in some ways, like, no one else interacts with this character except for our two young lovers, and as soon as the quote-unquote prophecy gets fulfilled, this old lady dies as though she was never really there at all.
Yeah, and the dog, there's this dog who can sort of see into another kind of spiritual realm, and he really keeps people away. So there's this community nurse who Sarah feels very close to named Daphne, and Daphne tries to go because, you know, I love how Sarah's kind of dumb. Like, hopefully she's like, you should come see Aunt Hattie. I think she needs vitamins. Like, okay. That's weird.
She needs help. This woman's starving to death in the woods, but she needs vitamins.
She specifically needs vitamins. But the dog won't let Daphne, like, cross the bridge to get to Aunt Hattie. So yeah, you're right, Joe. Mm-hmm. There is, like, there's something about where she lives and its realm. But yeah, there's moments of this book that I really enjoyed. And there's moments where I just felt like everything was happening so much in service of Sarah's character to the detriment of being able to tell the stories of the rest of these people, if that makes sense.
Okay. That's interesting because, you know, I do feel like we get a good, healthy portion from Mako's point of view. Often it's a little bit more spiritual, religious, prophetic. But, I mean, I'm not going to try to defend this too much because I do agree with you for the most part. But that also, to me, feels so emblematic of this era of young adult literature.
Oh, 100%.
And that, I think, to me, is why, in some ways, I'm almost willing to give this a pass. I feel like if you can acknowledge that it comes from a certain time period where this is just really how we wrote in diverse characters, it was like, basically, you're magical. You're here to help me as a white person on my spiritual journey. I just think that the book is really well written. Like, I really enjoyed the narrative. You know, to me, the most frustrating thing was just how quickly Sarah and Mako get annoyed with each other.
Oh, my
God. And you're
God.
Just like, meh. I guess that they're teenagers, but also maybe if you didn't read into literally everything that the other person said to you and, like, get your back up, it would be very... It'd be very helpful to me as a reader.
Well, I do think that Savage leans on the sort of tumultuousness of teenagehood, like, a little too much because...
A little too much.
It is often like, everything is fine, everything is fine, everything is fine. And then they're
everything's
fine.
Everything's awful.
Like, what is happening?
So true.
Can we talk a bit about Sarah and Pauline's relationship, though, before we go into the love story?
Well, how did I know you would want to talk about this?
I'm sort of fascinated by... I feel for Sarah, especially at the beginning of the book, right? She has come to be in this space with her mom. She's come to reconnect, rekindle this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She's like traveled across the world. She's obviously very committed to developing a relationship with her mom. And she gets there and she basically hits like a brick wall, right?
Yep. Yep.
Because her mom is unyielding. And of course, what we know as readers is that like, so is Sarah, right? Like this unwillingness to allow anything else to get in the way of your plan for yourself is exactly what Sarah has to unlearn through her relationships with Aunt Hattie and with Mako and the Albatross, right?
Exactly.
And Pauline never unlearns it. Like, we get to the end of the book and Pauline's like, oh, you got to go back early. Like, I got this new contract. See ya. You're like, oh, wow, you learned nothing this summer. And so I think that's really what I'm most interested in, is the decision to make Pauline an almost wholly unsympathetic character. Because while we do get the moment where she expresses her regret, any time that she has the opportunity to act on it, she doesn't, right?
Right, exactly.
So I'm interested in that because I think the book is really ultimately unsympathetic to Pauline. And in many ways, I think the book takes the same view as like... Aunt Hattie also is really unsympathetic to Pauline, and Daphne is really unsympathetic to Pauline. Mary is probably the most like, hey, you know, life happens and people are different people and you do what you can do. But yeah, I guess I'm curious because I always read everything, as you know now, like with a mom lens, and even I couldn't find a way to sympathize with Pauline. So I'm wondering about your reading of that character.
Yeah, some ways she struck me as more of a plot device than anything else. And again, maybe that's why I was a little bit more, not sympathetic, but I was a bit more understanding of how we were using the character.
Yeah.
Because I don't think she's presented as a bad person. She's just presented as a bad mother. So in some ways, this is a very 80s phenomenon, right? It's the woman who decided to prioritize her career and she excels at it. But in order to do so, she basically had to become a bad mother. And it feels like the other women in the text don't have a lot of sympathy for that. And because so much of our point of view is focalized through Sarah's perspective, you know, I think she forgives Pauline to a certain extent because she values her professional commitment. But as she becomes more of her own person and realizes, oh, that's not the way you have to do it. Like, I could be an amazing flutist, but also I don't need to be a terrible person. That's where the wheels really come off this relationship with Pauline. Like, to the point where when Pauline says, oh, I'm just going to send you home early, it is a deal breaker moment for both Sarah and the reader, because
yes,
it's like,
it totally
you
is.
Have not learned anything.
No, you haven't even tried to learn anything. And in many ways, it parallels. There's a scene earlier in the book where they go to the like nearest kind of market town for the day. I guess it's a port town because that's where all the supplies come in. And Pauline has to pick up all the equipment for her new lab. And she has so much stuff that she's like, oh, it's going to be pretty squishy going back. And Sarah's like, I'm just going
to
stay
here. You might have to ride
here.
On the roof.
And Sarah's like, I'm just going to stay here with Daphne. And Pauline's like, yeah, all right. You're like, in that scene, it's like, oh, okay, this is Pauline in her inability to see what Sarah is really looking for and her prioritizing her career. And it's so interesting that we basically have like a large scale replication of that scene again at the end of the book when she decides to send Sarah back.
Yeah, this reminded me a little bit about the catalog of the universe and the relationship that Angela has with her father, where we just have these characters who are a little one note for the purposes of a teenage centric narrative where it's like, okay, well, not only are we setting up a division between the ages, but also this is why you can't grow up to be like this person. You have to learn this lesson so that you don't become them.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it feels dated in the context of the sort of, there's a lack of nuance here that I think we have come to, we've just come to expect more nuance from more contemporary YA, I think, when it deals with family dynamics. And I'm trying not to be like overly critical. And I also, I don't know, the gender politics are just interesting here, right? Because in many ways, like, Pauline is like the capital F feminist, right? Who's like living her own life. And like, sure. You can picture her with like her big shoulder pads. And like, she's...
But she's very attractive. We're repeatedly reminded that Sarah is fat. And part of the reason that she doesn't love herself is because she doesn't look thin and professional and sexy like her mother.
She's so obsessed with fat, though. She is obsessed with the fact that Daphne is fat and doesn't seem to care. She's obsessed with the way, like, Mary is sort of, like, she just, all she talks about is body types. And then there's this scene, Joe, where she's supposed to take the pony, but she decides to take Celeste the horse instead. And when she looks at the pony, she's like, oh, that pony's so fat. And I was like, really? Even the pony is fat, Sarah?
But I like the fact that at the end of the story, when she comes to realize, oh, I don't need to be like my mother, she also realizes, you know what, I'm not actually fat. I can love myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's very 1980s, right? Because there's no version of reality where she loves herself and is fat.
Yeah, she never learns to love herself and be fat. It's that, oh, I can love myself because Mako loves me and because I can still be a successful flutist, sidebar, also fat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, it feels like a very dated version of body politics and gender politics. And for all of it, is still a really charming story. Like, I feel like I'm coming down harder on this than I intended to, because the problematic stuff is really problematic. Like, Savage is basically just mining Maori culture for, like, useful tidbits that are fun. Like, and there are parts of that that feel really uncomfortable to me. What did you think of the love story itself between Sarah and Mako?
Yeah, this is tricky, right? Because it's very much an opposites attract. You know, we're fighting the attraction through anger, through disagreements, and so on. I guess I ended up liking the idea that he needs her as much as she needs him. Like, we can definitely frame this as a white savior story where Sarah comes in and unlocks all of the problems and everybody learns a very valuable lesson by the end of the text. But I think that also undermines the fact that Savage is trying to address that there's something that Mako can learn and gain from Sarah, or just opening himself up to vulnerability and emotion, but maybe not just exclusively hate, in the same way that Sarah needs to learn, oh, okay, time can pass differently on the island. Seasons can be different. I can be different. So I certainly appreciate what you and anyone else who would critique this book for its antiquated points of view and how it is, yes, as you said, mining Maori culture. But there's an effort here. Like, this is a good intentioned failure where we didn't need to tell this story from this point of view. It could have just been white characters learning the exact same lessons. But I think something about Savage's time in New Zealand ended up affecting her to the point where she thought, you know what, there's a good story to be told here where I can also try to expose people to a different culture. And I think a different level of spiritualism, right? Like, the whole metaphor of the albatross is, yeah, it's a little bit heavy-handed, but it also works as a narrative device while simultaneously acknowledging the kind of spirituality that is emblematic of a Maori person.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I like your phrase of, like, a well-intentioned failure. I think part of what is hard on this book is to read it on the heels of something like Whale Rider, where, you know, in many ways, there's parallel conversations going on here, right? Like, both are about saving, or more importantly, liberating Maori culture. Both have this strong animal metaphor that runs through it. But what we have in Whale Rider is a more connected, grounded representation of what that story is without the white character being central. Whereas here, I think in many ways, Savage is trying to do something very similar. She's just doing it from the perspective of an outsider. And I think the scenes where the perspective is that of an outsider are actually the strongest ones. Like, when Savage is writing from her own experience and perspective as, you know, a white person viewing this culture with respect, but also questions, I think that those scenes actually work by far the best. I'm less comfortable with some of the kind of pseudo-spirituality representations, because they just seem very convenient to Sarah's progress as a character. And I think ultimately my problem is that I'm less interested in Sarah's development as a character than I am right. in all the other stuff that's going on around it. And so I really noticed when things were just happening in service of her, if that makes sense.
It does. So my question back to you then is this a byproduct of having read so many like-minded stories that we kind of feel like, I think within about the first chapter or two, you're going to realize, oh, I know Sarah's story. I know exactly yeah. where this is going to go because I've read this about 25 dozen times.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think, you know, it's again, an issue with making this show almost like out of time with the developments. Like, I can see why this book was fresh and radical and surprising in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. why it feels like none of those things now, unfortunately.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Brenna, there's a weird other thing that we are going to try to talk about, but can't exactly talk about. So, as we alluded to at the end of last week, there is a movie for this. We've not been able to track down a copy of it.
No.
But it's not a New Zealand film either, Brenna.
No, I'm sort of fascinated by the reviews of the film as well. So, Flight of the Albatross is a co-production, a German New Zealand co-production. And it sounds mm-hmm. like around the time it came out, Joe, there were a bunch of those happening. Like, it sounds like it was a particularly fruitful, like, relationship, co-producing relationship.
Okay.
And so in that version of the story, Sarah is not American. She's German.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she comes to New Zealand and it's this, like, it's the same story, but mm-hmm. she's German. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think that this is fascinating because you also indicated to me that Germany has an interest in indigenous storytelling. So this is not an isolated affair. This is not a strictly German New Zealand affair even.
Yeah, no, it's true. So there's a history in German culture of being particularly interested with North American, but also global indigenous communities, like to the point of it being problematic. There's
odd.
A really great there's a really great Drew Hayden Taylor documentary about the relationship particularly between Canadian Indigenous culture and this sort of like obsessive representation of it in German culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommend checking it out just because it's like I found it to be a bit of a mind bend. I was like, mm-hmm. wow, I didn't know like anything about this.
No.
And so I wonder if some of that is at play in the financing of a film like this and the resetting of it to be from a German teenager's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like the film has been mostly maybe better accepted than the book. It's hard because contemporary reviews of both are very positive and more recent reviews of the book are much more negative where you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
But the film was very careful to employ Maori yes. experts, Maori elders. Like there was a Maori presence on set at all times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like the inverse actually of the Whale Rider thing, right? Where we maybe had a more attentive effort to be specific about a particular Maori experience in the film than we get in the book, maybe.
Well, I would probably say it's equal to the filming experience of Whale Rider because they also employed the same elements. It's just a question of how much artistic license you ultimately take. And of course, we can't go any further in our comparison because we're unable to see the film, unfortunately. But
well, I know we have German listeners, Joe. So if German listeners have had access to this film.
Right.
It was cut as both a film and a four-part miniseries for German television. So
okay.
I'm very curious to find out if it was like mm-hmm. big. I don't think it was big because it's just as hard to find reviews of the film as it is to find reviews of the book. So I don't
right.
think it was like a smash or anything. But if folks who listen to the show have had access to the film or the TV version, I'd love to hear more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm fascinated. I guess the other question I want to put to listeners, I didn't have a good understanding, obviously, as I said off the top, of who Deborah Savage was as an author initially. She's had not a super prolific career, but she's got like a good handful of books.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was looking over her website, she actually has a book that came out in 1999 called Summer Hawk. And it's about a journalist who returns to her hometown where she helps with a rescued orphan hawk and a boy she'd never imagined being friends with. And I was like, did she just write the book again, but without the indigenous component? Because I wonder if that makes the story work better. So yeah, if anybody has read Summer Hawk, I would love to know, is this basically the same story?
Yeah, I'm sort of fascinated by Savage's body of work as a whole, because she also has a book that came out in 2002 called Kotuku.
Oh, and yeah.
That one is like set in Massachusetts, but they're like a person from New Zealand.
It's from New Zealand, comes. Yeah.
Comes, yeah, to like live. And the protagonist has like a famous ancestor who was actually like an early colonizer of New Zealand, it sounds like.
Oh, boy.
So obviously, like, Savage has some things to say about about the relationship between, like, the colonial history of New Zealand. And, like, there's obviously a lot. It's a well that she goes back to often. So, yeah, I'd also love to hear if we have Savage fans in the audience who can tell us a bit more about this body of work. Because I could not be more curious.
Right. Yes. Trepidatious and curious.
Yeah, and I know that one of the reviews on Goodreads of Kotuku points out that, like, the cover image is actually of, like, a white person with Maori tribal tattoos on their face. So I'm not sure if that's just, like, a bad cover design thing or emblematic of what's going on in the book thing. But yeah, I have so many questions. Her books are not easy to find, though, which is interesting because they've not been out of print long, really, in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
But they're almost impossible to track down.
Yeah.
At least in Canada.
Yeah. And maybe that's the issue, right?
Yeah.
Looking at the website, I do have questions about this artwork. Not with just that one book, but, you know, we talked about how misleading the Catalog of the Universe cover art is. And of course, Miriam wrote in to tell us about the Dutch cover art, which was much more successful.
Much better.
But, you know, I'm looking at the early book covers for something like A Stranger Calls Me Home and A Rumor of Otters, and they are so quintessentially 80s. Like, I'll post them on social media again, but
Stranger Calls Me Home is amazing.
What are we doing with cover art for YA in the 80s? I do not understand. I feel like we might have to do a mini-sode of just, like, bonkers cover art for YA books.
I would love that, because there's something fascinating to me. Like, none of the people look right. Like,
no, they don't look like human beings.
No, they don't. And they all have the same font for some reason. Like, did we only have one font in the 80s?
It was called cursive and slightly romantic.
And you cannot distinguish between, like, yeah, one of these books and, like, a Judy Blume book from the period. They all looked identical.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. Were we employing a single illustrator worldwide? I want to know.
Yeah, we'll have to do some research on that for a mini-sode, Joe. Do you think we've said all there is to say about Flight of the Albatross?
I think so. Should we try YA bingo?
Yeah, let's give it a go.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
So, you can argue with me, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if we want to give coincidental classes. Obviously, they're not in class, but Sarah is teaching Mako to read, and the kinds of things she's choosing to help him learn to read are, I think, telling. Like, they're reading Thoreau's poetry together. They're reading Dylan Thomas's poetry. Like, it's all sort of, they're predominantly, like, classics of North American and British literature, which I find really interesting. Which obviously is what her experience is. But can we just talk about how they never read Rime of the Ancient Mariner? Like, it's the most famous albatross. And yes, there's a stanza from Rime of the Ancient Mariner as a foreword to the book. Mm-hmm. But of all the poetry they never read together, they never read that.
I mean, maybe it's just not a favorite. Maybe that was too on the nose.
It made me mad, though. It's like, how much poetry are you guys going to read and not get to the famous albatross? So maybe not coincidental classes, but I just had to bring that up.
You know what? I think the fact that she's teaching him how to read and then he becomes a poet is a little, it's there.
Yeah. We've got a dead body for Aunt Hattie. We have many road trips. They're forever crossing this tiny island.
Yes, yeah.
And also they go to Auckland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We have borrowed time because everything has to happen within the context of the summer.
Yep.
Slash winter.
Slash winter.
Oh, gosh. You tell me. What do you have?
Okay, so I have abuse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can talk about whether Pauline's behavior is abusive. I would argue she is emotionally abusive.
She's certainly neglectful.
Yeah.
Neglect is a form of abuse, so.
Yeah. I am going to call Sarah something of a manic pixie dream person in mm-hmm. the eyes of Mako, and also in this prophecy that we have, yes. which I'm also going to give magic supernatural, because this feels more like Savage's construction as opposed to embedded within an mm-hmm. actual Maori idea.
100%, yes. Agreed with that.
Well, for all the reasons that we've talked about, capital P problematic, I'm going to say inauthentic voice.
Yes.
And then we do have a female writer.
Yes, we do. Do we want to go so far as to say that Sarah is a chosen one character?
So this is tricky because normally we would not say chosen one and manic pixie dream person for the same text.
Mm-hmm. Do you think right.
that's applicable?
Well, here's the thing. I think she's a manic pixie dream person to Mako, mm-hmm. but I think she's the Aunt Hattie says that Mako is the chosen one, but nothing can right. happen without Sarah, right?
Yeah. You know what? I think we can put them both in and say okay. that there is some weird stuff going on between the two characters.
Yeah, I agree.
I have a sexual awakening because Sarah learns to kiss and she likes it.
So there is a moment, Joe, right before they release the albatross where mm-hmm. I for sure thought they were about to have sex, like just in front of Aunt Hattie on the boat.
Oh my gosh.
Like, when they like lie down on the boat, I was like, Aunt Hattie's right there with the dying bird. Like, are you guys really?
Yeah. What's your problem?
Hot.
Super hot. Get in on that old lady threesome action. The only other one that I have is a perfect date. The day we go out and we see the dolphins and we get yes. to touch them.
Yes, that's a good one for sure. I would also, perfect date gone horribly wrong when they go to Goat Hill.
Oh, yeah. I won't lie. That to me was one of the more interesting passages of the book because it gets almost properly supernatural with the way that Sarah is seemingly put to sleep by the elements, yeah. and then Mako has this almost divine hallucination when he climbs up the hill. I thought it was really interesting, and part of me wants to see what that looks like visualized in the film, yeah. but we should also note that apparently Goat Hill, which is a real location on the island, it's a sacred space, so mm-hmm. they would not have been able to shoot on there, and frankly, when you see pictures of it, it does not look safe. That is a sheer rock cliff.
Yeah. And in the context of like Maori belief, as we have it depicted to us in the book, mm-hmm. the idea is that that's where people would go like to die, basically.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a both a sacred and a terrifying place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But all this to say, we got two lines out of this.
Wow. You know what? I take everything back. This was great.
Or this is very emblematic of YA from a certain time period.
It really is. I mean, I think it was worth reading for that reason, if for no other. Like, I think mm-hmm. it's always really interesting to explore eras of YA. And this definitely is very specific to its era.
Yes.
So if you want to write in about your experiences with Deborah Savage, if you have any, we're extremely curious. So please mm-hmm. do that. You can find us on most social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at BStoleMyRemote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray, and that's Gray with an A. And if you want to send us anything longer and get in the mailbag, you can email us HKHSPod@gmail.com. We're continuing our exploration of New Zealand with a film that I feel like I should have watched by now, which is Hunt for the Wilder People by Taika Waititi, which is actually based on a book called Wild Pork and Watercress. Still in the 1980s, Joe, we've read a lot mm-hmm. of 19. I feel like we have a very 1980s view of New Zealand at the end of this month.
Yeah, maybe that's another point of discussion, maybe through the mailbag, is whether there were other texts that we should have been focusing on. But the fact that we're getting movies from different eras out of these suggests to me that there was almost a golden age of children's literature, and then we caught up with it over time with film adaptations.
Yeah, I think there might be something in that. So I'm looking forward to exploring this one, Joe. And I know I came down hard on this one. It's not that I didn't enjoy the reading of it. I just, I don't know. I would love to read a version of this story where Mako gets to be a revolutionary and it's written from a Maori perspective. Like, I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because Barry Crump is a white man writing a teenage Maori boy's perspective in next week's episode. So I'm not sure if we'll have the same issues all over again. But I'm also very interested in this idea that there always has to be a white creative involved in any depiction of Maori people.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to also see what Taika Waititi does with that story. Yeah. So yeah, I'm very excited to see this sort of maybe a flip of what we've been looking at so far.
Let's hope so. Yeah.
All right, folks. So until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen.
The rest of the town is like, that lady is weird. And she should be...
Oh, great.
Whoa. You okay?
Fire alarm.
No. Oh, no. What do you want
to
do?
It's not scheduled.
Oh, no. Okay.
I was so happy.
Not the same thing you said before?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so no news then.